we're back. Stripe Show Podcast. I'm your host, Travis Fulton. Thank you for making us part of your day. Hope everyone is having a good week out there. We are almost in April. Hard to believe. My goodness. I tell you, I know time is just consistent, right? It just keeps on ticking, ticking into the future. Who was singing that song the other day? I can't remember. Now it's stuck in my head for the last two or three days. But, you know, it's consistent, and it doesn't speed up, and it doesn't slow down. But yet somehow, here we are. It's almost April 1st next week. The first quarter is almost done. Augusta is less than 2 weeks away. I don't understand. I don't understand how we got here so quickly. When I go home back west, and I go up and see my family in Idaho or Montana, I swear that time slows down up there. Maybe my mind is on East Coast time, 3 hours ahead. Where we get up there, it's 3 hours behind. But it feels like there's 30 hours in the day. When I go up there, it's like, my God, it's only 2:30 in the afternoon. And then here, it's like, how did we get to 7 p.m. already? And it's light out later and all that. So anyway, it's just hard to believe, man. It just goes quicker and quicker as your kids get older. And I think sometimes you have to take a step back and you have to slow down. And you have to, I think, really recognize and appreciate the things that are happening around you and appreciate the people that are on this journey with you. And appreciate and reflect back to those that have influenced you. And where I'm going with this in today's podcast to start with, and I'm going to talk about a number of things here today. I talk about Rory McIlroy winning the Players Championship, which I was out there a couple days. And then I got to play TPC. And I don't know if you saw my shot on Instagram on 17. I almost hold it. Almost made a hole-in-one on 17. It's crazy. So I'll talk about that. I talk about Victor Hovland, who back in the winner's circle in Valspar, which is awesome. You know, I mean, hey, Victor Hovland, part of the equation in professional golf is a really good thing. I've got some thoughts on that. You know, I've been a little bit critical, I think, of Victor over the last two or three years and the way that he's kind of jumped around with coaches. I want to talk about that and I think what that means and how, you know, maybe that may affect you going into the season, thinking about maybe some lessons. I'm going to look at Victor's swing. I don't know the inside on Victor's swing and what the hangup is as far as him not knowing where the ball is going to go. When you listen to Victor talk, it sounds like he has absolutely no idea where the ball is going to go. So we'll get into that. But I want to start by taking a step back, slow things down here a little bit, and recognizing a man who passed away yesterday, Dave Pels. And Dave Pels, no question, is a Hall of Fame coach, one of the best to do it. Whether you agree with everything Dave Pels had to say, everything that he maybe published in his books, some iconic books, the Short Game Bible, the Putting Bible, there were others. You know, Dave Pels dedicated his life to the game of golf, and particularly teaching the short game. He was one of the first, really, I think, to, you know, kind of push out there and brand himself as a specialist in a particular part of the game. I can remember, you know, when I got into the teaching business back in 1999 when I graduated college over on the West Coast, you know, in my mind, I was like, you know, I don't think I have a whole lot of marketable skills. And I love golf. I was a decent player. Probably the best I ever got to was maybe a plus one. I don't know, somewhere in there. I was, you know, when I was really working at it, I could take an under par. Maybe I was a plus two. I don't know. But I wasn't a professional golfer. Like, I knew that my skills were not going to pay my rent playing golf. And also, I didn't love playing golf. I enjoyed it. I worked at it. I was decent at it. I love playing small college golf, but I didn't love the grind of practicing and playing every day. Let's go. And so I knew I wasn't going to play professional golf, but I enjoyed the sport. I loved the sport, everything about it. And so I made the decision that, look, I'm going to teach. And so I started to get into teaching in a small driving range in Clarkston, Washington, home of Joel Damon, who I saw, him and his caddy, Gino Bonelli, who grew up in Lewiston, Idaho, right across the Snake River. That's where I went to college, Lewis and Clark right there. And small driving range, Gateway Center. And beautiful, right on the Snake River. I mean, just unbelievable. It's still there. It's called something else now. And so I started teaching there. And I had this little TV. And I would film, take the tape, go put it into the TV. I would show it to them. And I had dry erase markers. And I would draw on the TV and show them. And basically, I had no idea what I was doing. But I felt like I was helping people. And I was passionate about it. And as I started doing that, I was like, you know what? I like this. I love this, I think. It's satisfying. It's gratifying. It's interesting. In fact, the more I do it, the more money I make. So I felt incentivized. So I started to go down this path, but I realized like, look, I gotta figure this out. I gotta figure out how to get into a situation where I can teach. And I realized at that time that there weren't a lot of people teaching full time. There were not a lot of people that were doing it on a full time status. There were some. But we were kind of transitioning into that era to some degree. And so as I started to research and you know, read books, there were a number of big names at that time, right? I mean, obviously, you know, Butch Harmon, Hank Haney, Jim McClain. You know, I loved Rick Smith when he was on Golf Channel, Dean Reinmuth, who else? You know, Jim Flick. And Dave Pelz. And so I remember, you know, getting the short game Bible and the putting Bible and, you know, reading those things as I was on my journey. But I always kind of looked at those guys and I was like, look, I'm going to learn from those guys. But the one thing that really stood out is like, okay, they're doing this full time. This is what they do for a living. And so that inspired me. And Dave Pelz was part of that equation. And I remember the short game schools, which were wildly successful. And so I packed up and I moved to Scottsdale. I'm not going to get into the whole story. And I got into a group with Resort Golf and we started traveling the country. And as we started traveling the country, one of our stops was in Carmel, New York. Now I spent about a year in New York. I taught at Doral Arrowwood full time in Westchester County, just above the city. And there was another property that we were offering schools up in Carmel. And the, what is the name of that place? Centennial. That's the name of the golf course. Really hilly place. Beautiful driving range, practice facility. Well, there was a David Ledbetter school and there was a Dave Pelz school. And I would go up there from time to time and I would teach resort golf schools. And we would have, you know, two or three people or whatever. But I can always remember pulling up. And Pelz wasn't there a lot, but I did see him, I think maybe once or twice at that property. But I can just always remember like pulling in. I was like, wow, you know, Dave Pelz school. Look how successful he is. This building, he's got 16 people in a short game school. Like, I mean, it was just like, my goodness. It really opened my eyes to, wow, this is a business. And I saw a little bit of it with Resort Golf, and they were very successful back in Scottsdale, and there were some bigger schools. But I just like, you know, Dave Pelz, his name was on it. Dave Pelz, the man, this big figure. And I could just always remember pulling up there when I would do a school, and I would look at this place, and I was just kind of in awe of the success. His name was on it, and it was inspiring, very much so inspiring. And so that went on for a year, and it got to Florida. And then eventually, as you know, I started working for Golf Channel, and I had some interactions with Dave here and there through that journey. He was very much part of the Golf Channel fabric for many, many years. And so I didn't really know Dave that well, but every time that I did interact with him, everything that you would read on social media is completely accurate, and that the man was just a very nice man, very approachable, big figure, you know, just a presence, confident, but very nice, welcoming. And he just had an effect on me, obviously, in meeting him, which was inspiring, but just his brand and his specialization to the sport, his knowledge, just the whole package was impressive. So, you know, the game of golf lost a really good one, a good person, yesterday, someone who's really, I think inspired a lot of people my age to do this full time, to follow your passion and, you know, build a brand on your name. He did it just incredibly well. And as I finish up this thought, I was driving in this morning, I got to thinking about all the other people that I've got to know through this journey that I can remember back in 99 and 2000 and getting into the game, you know, the icons of our industry and how I've got to know these people. They've been on the podcast. It's really interesting. You know, it's fascinating. And sometimes I got to pinch myself, you know, like, hey, I can reach out to Jim McClain and talk to him and have him on the podcast and, you know, and pick his brain. I mean, talk about great people. I can, you know, interact with Rick Smith, who's one of my favorites, and, you know, just a wealth of knowledge and success, with his brand. And, you know, the list just goes, you know, on and on. And you've seen him here, you know, David Ledbetter. I mean, David Ledbetter, I could reach out to David and talk to him. He was in my studio, came up kind enough to do an in-studio series. And it's like, what? I mean, these guys are just, you know, they're very successful. They've paved the way. But above all that, they're really good people. And so I think you got to take a step back. And you got to recognize these people. And as Dave Pels passed away yesterday, which was sad news, I just wanted to pay my respects to him and all those really of that era. And a lot of them are still alive and doing well and teaching, and how they've, you know, they've helped me and inspired me to get to this point. Travis Fulton Golf, this studio, we're building another one downtown. We've got some other good things coming up, and it all adds up, man. You know, the inspiration is real. It's just me today. I'm going to get into TPC here in a second. Going to get into Victor Hovland, had some thoughts. Next week, we get back with our guest. Got a gentleman by the name of Riley Andrews coming on next week. Go check out Riley. It's on Instagram, coach_Riley_EGS. He's part of Elite Golf Schools. He's out in Scottsdale, got some other locations. And got some, you know, we got good discussion with him on the way that when I watch his stuff, I like it. In the way that he teaches rotation through impact, getting the club around the corner. So we're going to get into that with Riley next week on the Stripe Show podcast. A couple thoughts on TPC. You know, Rory McIlroy and even Victor Hovland, who has won Valspar since, right? The last 2 weeks we've got Rory McIlroy and Victor Hovland. PGA Tour is doing just fine. Ratings are doing well. It's good to see things have rebounded. PGA Tour, I think, is in a position of strength right now. There's no question with these negotiations with LIV. Would I like to see them come back together and these guys play together again? Of course, any fan would like that. But in the world of business, I'm not sure PGA Tour needs LIV. I'm not sure that they really need LIV to be successful and continue to get the numbers that they need and, you know, and eyeballs from a TV and digital and all that. So will a deal get together? I don't know. Yeah, at this point, who knows? As a fan, would I love to see all these guys play together more consistently? Of course. You know, it's going to be awesome to see the guys back together at Augusta. But if we only get it four times a year, that's fine. The PGA Tour is just fine without these people. But Rory McIlroy wins again. And when I watch Rory, and you just come to realize the greatness of Rory McIlroy, basically winning the Players' Championship, the biggest tournament on the PGA Tour, deep field, on a golf course that doesn't favor Rory. I mean, it kind of, you know, basically minimizes what he does well, which is bomb it with his driver, which has been a little bit erratic here and there. But it's not a golf course that favors a bomber. I mean, it's everybody can win there. We've seen it play out over time. And that's the brilliance of that golf course. But Rory goes out there and basically wins with his B game. I mean, he did. I mean, he won that tournament with his B game, his second Players' Championship. And Rory, I think, is still probably fighting it right now. We haven't seen this full go, full send. Everything's hitting at the right time. And nothing would make me happier to see it happen at the Masters, where it just all comes together. And I believe that if that's the case, there's no one beating Rory. I do believe still that the A game of Rory beats the A game of anybody in the world. And that includes Scottie Scheffler. And that's no shot at Scottie Scheffler. It's not. But I just think it's must-watch TV when Rory's got it all going. And he's engaged, he's focused, and the whole bit. But what strikes me with Rory is, like, he wins with his B game. And it's not just all technique. I think a lot of it still is just, like, the focus and just the little mistakes. I mean, I watched a lot of Rory play those 4 days. And I'm telling you, like, it was 5-6 shots just thrown away. Just little silly things just thrown it away. And he overcomes it. His brilliance, his shot-making things that he can do. That three-wood that he hit on number 9, I think was it Sunday or Saturday, Sunday? I can't remember. I'm telling you. I when I played it on Tuesday afterwards, I went to that spot. And I just sat there and I looked at it and I'm like, okay, I'm going to hit 3-wood from here over those trees on the left and land in the middle of the green. Like, what? Yeah, there's just not many that can hit that shot. Those are the kinds of things that he can do. He can make elite players look small. And so that shot that he hit on 9, it's just mind-boggling, right? And the short game shots, one of the things that I think has really developed with short game or with Rory around the greens are those little finesse shots, you know, where he kind of picks it up, drops it, clips it. I mean, those little medium trajectory around the green, maybe medium to high. I mean, that guy's got it. Unbelievable. He don't get enough credit for that. I think his putting, you know, the stuff that he's done with Brad Faxon, and I give Rory a lot of credit there that feels like he's kind of stayed the course with Brad. But you know, there's still, I think he's fighting the swing a little bit and kind of what he's doing. You know, it's interesting with Rory. I think he's trying to get the club a little more laid off. You see a lot of the stuff where he kind of goes up and he's pitching the shaft back, trying to lay it off a little bit more. Rory's not afraid to put a swing device on and, you know, feel some of those things. So I still think he's kind of trying to work through that a little bit. But my God, I mean, the guys, it's the elite of the elite talent. It's the elite of the elite talent. You know, can throw shots away, just little mental mistakes, maybe loses his focus, whatever, and still go out there and win with his B game and the Players' Championship on a course that's not really, you know, maximizing his strength. I mean, it's really crazy stuff and just how great he is. I hope at Augusta he has his A game. Nothing would be better for the game of golf. Rory McIlroy, A game at Augusta, completing the Grand Slam. Be awesome. When I played TPC, I shot about 78. Not a few people reach out. It was funny. I tweeted, I said, my over-under 78.9. And I shot 78. And I look, full transparency, you know, very casual round, you know, moving the ball around a little bit. But if I had to, like, yeah, I was right at about 78. I made four double bogeys, three birdies, three bogeys. Damn. I don't think I made a par until like the sixth hole. But we started on 17. First hole, 17. Knocked it 3 feet. Sunday pins. Didn't have my 8 iron in my bag. So wind was into us. Gripped down a 7. Flipped it in there. Hit the slope. Came down 3 feet. Thought it might go in. So here we are, 2. Go to 18. Pipe one down the middle. Second shot. Hit one on the front of the green. 3 putt. One. Then we go to 1. Great drive, left side. Caught a flyer. I was on the first cut. Caught a flyer, went over, chipped it up to 5 feet, left it short, bogey. Go to 2. Listen to this. I mean, this is monkey golf out of the gate. Go to 2. Hook my driver, hits the tree, drops it straight down. 70 yards. I'm in the rough on the left. Take my 4 iron, punch it out. Run it up there. I'm like 240, 235, 240. Take my 3 wood, grip down slightly. Maybe one of the best shots I hit. Just hit this little piercing cut 3 wood, chase it up there to like 6 feet and make it for birdie. Oh, man. You know, it's just one shot at a time. You just keep going. I mean, this is the kind of golf that you can play out there. And you can just make doubles so quick. You know, I mean, just one little error. You can make double. The course is just exceptional. The fairways are so good. You know, that overseeded rough, look, it's long, but it's a lot easier to play out of than the old Bermuda. That old Bermuda was gnarly, man. This new strain of grass and overseeded course here, I mean, it's just a different kind of grass. It's much easier to play out of. It doesn't make the course easy, don't get me wrong, but it is easier than the older Bermuda that they used to have. But the greens are so good. You know, quick, you put a little wind on that thing and it's just all you want. I mean, you just have to be so precise. And if you lose it out there, you know, there's a few guys shooting in the 80s. I mean, Victor Hovland, I think, shot 80. So, you know, that was kind of golf anyway. Great. It was just, you know, what a privilege it was to go out there and play and be a part of that media event out there. And played pretty good. You know, I hit a lot of good shots. I made a lot of putts too. That was the key. I made a lot of putts. My lab putter, the Oz, 2 degrees of forward lean. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I hit so many good putts, made a lot of putts, or else I would have been into the mid 80s. No doubt. So, if you're like most golfers, you blame yourself when you miss a short putt. So after you hold back the urge to throw your putter in the lake, don't do that. You try to fix your putting stroke. But how long does that last? 1 week, one round, one hole? There's a company called Lab Golf that doesn't think you should be blaming yourself. That's because all putters have this thing called torque, which means the putter face is trying to twist during stroke, so you grip it like a snake. What Lab Golf did is they figure out how to make putters with no torque. They call it lie angle balance. And you have to feel it to believe it. I did. The Lab Golf putter, you don't have to use a funny putting grip to try to keep the face square. You can putt it any way you want because Lab Golf Putter stays perfectly square by itself. It's effortless. To see how much easier putting can be, head over to labgolf.com. So, TPC Sawgrass is coming gone. Valspar, Victor Hovland wins. And as I want to get in here and talk about Victor here a little bit. And there's me and Victor. Look at that. I played with Victor. Right before he turned pro. I think this was 2019. And that's at, Arnold Palmer Invitational. So I played in the prime there a few times and this year I got matched up with Victor before he turned pro and you can see he's in his college outfit there. And we had a great day. I mean, you know, Victor is a great young man. You know, just a kind of interesting discussion, a deep thinker. And we had a great day that day. And I can remember, I can't remember exactly how I played that day, but what I do remember is, you know, Victor Hovland hitting it through a thimble off the tee. I mean, like, just absolute, yes. Oh, dare I say, stripe show off the tee. And we had a great day, and he was so good with all of us in the group. And Victor is a very nice young man. What's been fascinating in watching Victor, since turning pro, is that he's, we're up to 11 teachers now. I think since turning pro, I think he's had 14 or 15 through his entire career. But we're at 11 coaching changes, consultation, however you want to word it, since turning pro. You go back to in college, his coach was Denny Lucas, and then as he gets into turning pro, Joe Mayo, and then Pete Cowan, then Lucas Wald, Jeff Smith, back to Joe Mayo, Grant Waite, Dana Dahlquist, back to Joe Mayo, TJ Yeaton, back to Denny Lucas, and now I think currently we're back to Grant Waite. So these are these are great teachers, all of them. Teachers that I've learned from, a lot of these guys have been on the podcast. TJ Yeaton used to work for me when I was running the PGA Tour Academies. Worked for us for a couple years down at the World Golf Village. Very talented young teacher at the time and has done very well since. He actually worked here even after the PGA Tour Academies went away. He was at Atlantic Beach, I believe, for a little bit, and now he moved to Tennessee, I believe. But, just a terrific mind. Joe Mayo, we know, is a fabulous mind and teacher. I love Dana Dahlquist. Grant Waite, fabulous mind. Jeff Smith, terrific mind and teacher. I mean, just, all these guys. And so these are some, high quality dudes. And Victor has jumped around quite a bit here. I mean, a lot. That's a lot of jumping around. And so you look at Victor heading into this event, and it's three missed cuts? Misses the cut at the Genesis, misses the cut at Arnold Palmer, misses the cut at Players, and then he wins Valspar. That's golf, right? I mean, it's just, is that golf? I mean, I don't know if that's, golf for everybody to go from miscut to a win. I mean, that's a little exaggerated to say that's golf for everybody. But any given day or week, things can turn around, right? We can find something and off we go, especially with these guys. They can. And I think when you look at Victor's stats, I mean, the biggest thing that stands out in the win at Valspar is his putting. He was positive 7.4. That's the best putting tournament that he's ever had since turning pro. Positive 7.4. He's never done that. So his best putting stats ever. His short game continues, for whatever reason, to be his weakness. He's losing strokes to the field, 1 to 2 strokes around the greens. His iron game now seems to be improving. Positive 5.9 at Valspar, and he drove the ball, his best tournament in driving the ball this year, positive 2 at Valspar. So maybe he's finding something, right? Maybe he is, but then you listen to his interview afterwards, and I think he was talking to Dan Rappaport on his podcast, and he was basically saying, I have no idea where the ball was going to go. I was just praying that when I hit it, I looked up, it was going straight, and then I was praying that it was the right distance. What? I mean, this is more annoying than Hideki Matsuyama hitting a shot and letting go of it with one hand, and it lands at 6 feet. Now we're at a level of he has no idea what he's saying, that he has no idea where the ball is going, and he's winning a PGA Tour event at Valspar. So, what do you make of all this, right? It's just hard to filter through all of this. You look at all these teachers, and I mean, I don't think a lot of teachers listen to this podcast. I don't think there's any teacher that's going to have a student come in and say, hey, I got two scenarios. One is, over the next year, I want to really work on my game and commit. Should I commit to you and really, one teacher, I like your style and give this a period of time and go through this and really, trust in the process and all these things that we hear? Or should I, maybe just go do a bunch of lessons with 7 or 8 different people? What are most how are most teachers going to answer that? How are most sports psychologists going to answer that, right? We know that, you have to kind of dig in, believe in a process, and turn the wheels and go. And even in that process, there's going to be ups and downs. Like, we know that. Jumping around, I think every time you do jump around, a new idea, a new concept, like, you are going to sacrifice some time to, you know, let that mature a little bit. And then you change it again, and then that kind of cycle starts over again. And so I'm not a big fan of all of this jumping around. I do think there's some red flags in there. In that, you know, I mean, what's really going on here, you know, with Victor? Victor strikes me, yes, he's a great person. Love being around him. But he does strike me as someone who would be very difficult to teach. Very difficult to teach. I would say demanding to teach. I think even to the degree of probably some hand holding here of, hey, this is what we're doing. Trust the process. Make sure, you know, we're doing A and B, you know, stay with it, blah, 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 and always reinforcing. And Victor's nature is always the challenge and try to, you know, find the solution or find the magic or whatever. But the reality is, I think with Victor is he has the magic within. Like, he is a genius at this game. He is a ball striking genius. He is a elite. I would put elite of elite, you know, like in that category. I think Rory, you know, and Scotty and like, but that ceiling, that high ceiling that these guys have, like, I think Victor has that. He is a genius at this sport. Like Spieth like. And I do think that as you just continue to kind of change and this and that, and okay, that didn't work. This one, like, I do think there is some erosion in there. And I do think there is some sacrifice of time. I do give him a lot of credit and like, look, all right, you know, he's obviously an extremely hard worker. But man, you know, is this sustainable? Like, I think that's the question I would ask is this really sustainable for him? And is he going to wear everybody else out around him, you know, in all these brilliant minds that he's working with? So I hope that with Victor, that he finds some peace here. Like, he finds someone that, hey, this is where we're going. This makes sense. And we just kind of go down that path and we stay with that. And we work through a little bit of the ups and downs. And that we start building upon this process and letting this genius come out, because it's in there. Victor winning through all this, everything I just said, Victor winning speaks to the absolute genius that he is. Just speaks to it. I mean, it's mind-boggling. It really is. It almost doesn't even make sense. Right. It almost doesn't even make sense. Like, all of these coaching changes, listening to him talk, even after winning, and the fact that he goes out there and wins a PGA Tour event. Man, there is special inside, something very special in there. And I believe that he has got to. He's got to hone in now. He's got to hone in here at some point. Settle in. Believe and let these wheels turn, build confidence, and let this genius come out. And let it come out. And maybe it's Grant Wade. Maybe this is where he needs to be. But wherever it is, like, I don't know how sustainable it is to continue. We're going to add another 11, 12 teachers over the next three or four. I mean, maybe I'm completely wrong on this. And I wonder, like, you know, you look at Victor's swing, and I want to talk about his swing here, and you look at it, and I kind of wonder, you know, what it is that he's trying to get back to. I don't know. Like, I'm not told too much. You know, Victor is a absolute power fader of the ball. It's a swing that I will use from time to time as an example. You know, you look at Victor, you know, he's a player who his hand path gets in. It's kind of interesting. Like, sometimes I hear people explain Victor swing like, well, he takes it inside. I don't think it's inside. Like when you look at the club shaft parallel to the ground, like the alignment from the club head to the hands is still in line, right? I mean, his, like, that's a straight line between the shaft and the left arm. And so I don't see the club head inside. Now, if the club head was behind the hands there, well, now we're, you know, now we've got something to talk about. But that's in line. That's on the toe line. Now, what Victor does do is his hand path does go in. His left arm is up against his pec. So his hand path is going in. And his left arm, you know, kind of works back around, covers his right shoulder. And then this kind of over move is his hand path working back out in front, right? So to me, his hand path really goes in. And then from there, it kind of arcs back out in front of him on the downswing. And that's a fade kind of pattern, right? His hand path arcing out in front, and he can cover it, really rotate back to the left. The other thing that, you know, when you look at Victor, and this is the thing that I will use oftentimes with people, is the shape of the club shaft. So you look at the pitch of the shaft when he gets the left arm parallel right there. Like the pitch of that shaft is pretty vertical. Okay, I mean, that shaft is pretty vertical. The butt of the club is pointing well inside the ball target line. Now, when we start down, yes, his hand path arcs back out in front, but the shaft lays down. So now the shaft is closer to 45. Victor probably has one of the bigger shallowing of the club shaft out there. He has to, because the shaft is damn near 90 degrees going back. So that shaft is now laying down, right, and shallowing in relationship to where it was going back, with his hand path arcing back out in front of him. And then he turns and hits it. Now, as we play it again, the other component here would be the club face. Victor, fairly strong left-hand grip, and he takes his – when you look at this right here, and this is the other thing that I will use with players right here. I will use oftentimes with players, I will get them to feel two things there with the wrist. One is the right wrist. Yes, it's bent, but the palm of the right hand is kind of turned away from Victor. See that? The palm of the right hand looking towards the camera. The back of the left hand looking towards the camera. I bet you Victor's kind of rolling those bottom three fingers underneath. So he's kind of turning. Let me do this to the camera here. So I'm turning the right hand away, left hand curling like that. Okay, that flexes the lead wrist more, but it kind of helps. It helps kind of stand the shaft up a little bit, and it helps get the club face in a more closed position. Now, from there, I mean, that's a move that, look, I like for a lot of amateurs and players who will roll it inside, get the club shaft too horizontal with the face too open. Now, from that position, they have no choice but to come over the top. With Victor, right hand bent, turned away, left hand flat or more flexed, faces in a closed position, looking back towards the camera. So now when he starts down, the shaft shallows out in transition. I think that's good advice for so many. Not all, but for a lot of amateurs looking to hit a stronger top type of ball flight, that kind of feeling in the wrists right here, and then what that means in transition coming down. So it's interesting, right? I mean, it's just, you just look at this swing, and it's like textbook fade pattern, a very much a power fade, because the club face is in a strong position. You know, that's what makes it the power fade. The club face is in a strong position. He de-lofts it at impact. But because his hand pass arcing back out in front of him, and of course he just rotates so well, and he rotates to the left, the path is left of that, and he hits his power fade. So he's hitting a power fade with a strong club face position. He's not hitting a power fade from a weak club face position. I put this up there, this picture here. I think this was back in when he was working with Jeff Smith. And keep in mind when that run, I think it was 2 or 3 years with Jeff, like I think he got to like number three in the world. You know, like he was playing some great golf. And I look at this, and again, I don't know. Like, I don't know what he's working on, but I look at this, and this is an iron swing, and this I took a picture at the top. And you know, same kind of wrist angles, but the shaft is maybe not as across the line. I think maybe, I wonder, I should say, at times does Victor maybe get the hand path a little too in, and then the shaft gets a little too across, and then when he starts down the path face configuration through impact isn't exactly what he's looking for. The ball's not starting in the window that he wants. So, you know, as I watch him and his rehearsals, and sometimes I get the impression that maybe he's trying to get the shaft a bit more down the line at the top, maybe a little less across. And then from there, when he starts down, he gets more of the path face configuration that he's looking for. There's clearly something through the impact zone that he's not happy with, obviously, in the way the ball starts and the way that he feels like he has to save it or whatever. And save it at spades, he does. Forget about Hideki letting go with one hand. The dude wins a tournament. And he's talking, talking like he has, like, whether or not the ball's going to get off the ground. So I wonder if maybe that's where he's trying to go. You know, keep in mind, again, he was number three in the world at this time with Jeff. I mean, there was a point when he was working with Joe Mayo, I think the first time. He, of course, won, you know, 2023 when he was working on a short game was improving. He won the BMW champion and the tour championship. You can make the argument that Victor Hovland is the best player in the world at the end of 2023. And since that time, he's changed coaches 6 times. 5 or 6 times. You know, the guy's had success, right? I mean, he's played at an elite level. I think he's back up to number 8 now. He's climbed the ladder. He's been there. He's done this. He's a genius. But then when he gets up there, he starts changing. And why? Like, why is he changing? You know? Why is he changing? When do you settle in and just, you know? At some point, there's erosion there. It's going to catch up at some point. But the genius is there. He's still a young guy. It is in there. Victor Hovland is elite of the elite. He is. His ceiling is maybe not as, you know, overall, maybe not as high as Rory because of his short game. His short game still is not good. And his putting up to Valspar has not been good. He had the best putting week of his career at Valspar. Positive 7.4. He was positive 5.9 strokes gained approach with his irons. In his interview with Dan Rapoport afterwards, he acted like he didn't know whether or not he was going to get the ball off the ground. Oh, man. Crazy. Crazy, crazy. All right, good stuff. A few thoughts there on Victor Hovland. You know, I think I'll end with this. You know, golf season's near, spring, summer. And my advice to you is people get into like taking lessons. I just go back to, you know, the role of how I view kind of my role. And most amateurs, as they want to improve, like they have to improve their skill set, right? They have to elevate their ceiling. And at the same time, I would say elevate their floor. Right. I think that's part of moving the needle towards improving your skill set. Like your good shots are getting better, but your misses are not as bad. You start eliminating some of those big misses the dispersion gets tighter. And sometimes, you know, as that happens, it takes a little bit to translate into putting it together over 9 holes or 18 holes, let alone a full golf tournament or week to week. But the reality is even as you improve, even as those skill sets improve, like there's still going to be misses. There's still going to be that range of scores that you're capable of shooting. And that range is big, folks. It's not like consistency is not shooting 79, 80, 81 every single day. Like you're going to shoot, if you're shooting a lot of 79s and 80, you're going to shoot an occasional 85, 86. You're going to shoot occasionally 74, 75, 76. Like occasionally those are going to be in there. Sometimes they're going to happen back-to-back days. Sometimes you're going to shoot 85, and the next year you're going to shoot 75. It doesn't mean you're inconsistent. It doesn't mean you're inconsistent. That's golf. That's the range. Justin Thomas at the Players, what did he shoot? 70, 72 the first day? 73? Or no, it was higher than that. It was 75 the first day. What did he shoot the second day? 61. Then the third day shot 72. I mean, is Justin Thomas inconsistent? I mean, Justin Thomas so inconsistent. Oh. It just happens. I mean, just, you know, that's the range you have, how your body feels that day, your mental focus, luck, 10 to 15%, how the bounces go. There's just a lot of things that go into this, right? And you have to kind of take it all in, but you do have to see some progress as you go and feel that and sense that. And I think as a coach, for me, like as I start developing technique, like my job is I got to get people the right information. As you start going down this path and you plug into a teacher, you know, you want to get great information, but you got to make sure that the teacher's putting it in the right order and it makes sense. Here's what we're going to do. And here's why. This is the order we're going to put it in. And as we start to do that and develop that, here's kind of what's going to happen from there, right? As we start to anticipate how the impact condition is going to start to improve and what that's going to suggest in the way of ball flight and maybe in the way of a miss, in the way of maybe a different kind of miss and a different kind of ball flight. And then as that kind of develops within that context, then maybe we'll see where that takes us. And, you know, and then we add the next layer. And so it is a journey. And the journey never ends. But along that journey, people, there are ups and downs. This is a hard game. The dispersion of scores, that range of scores never goes away. You have to improve the skill set. You have to elevate all boats. Elevate your ceiling. Elevate your floor. And as you do those things, I think, and you have that expectation level, I think you'll enjoy the game more thoroughly. And you won't wear out the people around you, the teachers around you. All right. Good stuff. Stripe Show, thanks for being here today. Next week, back to got a great guest. You're going to enjoy this with Riley Andrews. He's going to join me. And we're going to go through some cool stuff. Cool stuff in particularly on rotation through impact and how to get the club to turn the corner. I'm excited about this one. I'm also going to work on getting some guys on about this whole debate in the golf instruction world about the left shoulder going down versus across. Like there's, you know, a lot of people up in arms about that. So we'll get into that probably the following week. Okay. So we got some good stuff coming up. Stripe Show Pod. Thanks for being here. See you next time. See ya.